welcome for seminar. I'm very happy that today we can welcome our, I would say old friends, but old is a relative, you know. So old in the sense of our cooperation is really, especially with Tanya, started in 1993 or 4, at that time, so is it? Oof, almost 20 years. And so we had a very nice project with the African, and I'm happy that we could welcome them, and them, and the group here to get information on a project proposal, on a project on information that's in encoding. And I don't know who will be the
first. I will start with you.
So please.
So thanks, Eva, for the introduction, and it's kind of good to be back here. As kind of Eva mentioned, we had the PIO Corporation for a couple of years, having a good excuse coming kind of very regular to this kind of beautiful city and the institute. And now we found another excuse in another framework. So what we'll be talking about is no results, just basically the project proposal and the specific plans that we have, and of course open questions where we would be very happy about your input. The talk will be split, so kind of I will give something like 10 minutes overview about the bigger framework, and then Andrea, Irina and Clara will be talking about the specific project. So the title here is kind of CRC, some funny number, information density and linguistic encoding. And perhaps first a few words about what CRC stands for. It stands for Collaborative Research Center. That is, the German Science Foundation has different types of funding schemes. Either you can go for individual grants or this or that or exchange programs, or you can go for this kind of Collaborative Research Center. It's a really kind of the biggest funding scheme there is. So in total it funds 30 positions on top of the faculty. So we have just more or less completely hired around 10 postdocs and 20 PhD students. I think there's kind of one position still vacant, but the other just started. So it started on October 1st, and this is the reason why there are kind of open questions, but no answers and no results. The overarching theme is information density and linguistic encoding. So the general observation is that when you have a certain message, a certain piece of information that you want to convey, like going for dinner at a certain place in Prague, you have various ways of expressing the same information. And the question is kind of, how do you choose which encoding of a message to use? Here are some examples. So we have here, my boss confirmed that he's absolutely crazy versus my boss confirmed he's absolutely crazy. It's a minor difference here, the absence or presence of that. And a possible question could be, in which situations do you choose, even though both are syntactically correct, in which situations do you choose to add a that, when can you omit it? Or here another example, I don't dare to read the Czech version here. So it's basically kind of different ways of saying where to put stuff in a colloquial, informal manner. Both the ways of phrasing it are essentially identical. And again, the question is kind of, is there any criterion that helps you decide which wording to use? A third example, if this method of control were to be used, trains would operate more safely, versus the use of this control method leads to safer train operation. So here we have explicitly saying that one thing follows from the other, whereas here it's more implicit. And the same thing also happens on the acoustic side. So we have here two different utterances, both using the word mind. And what you find is that in this situation, pronouncing the word mind takes 25% longer than in this setting. And so we have kind of different ways of expressing the same message. And we have degrees of freedom on the phonetic side, on the morphological side, on the lexical side, on the syntactic side, on the discourse side, lots of degrees of freedom where you can vary how to express things. And as said, the question is kind of what does trigger how to vary and where to vary. And there have been psycholinguistic experiments, I think something like 5 to 10 years ago, that indicate that what humans try to do is keep the amount of additional information at roughly a constant rate. That is, speakers try to design utterances such that for the receiver, for the consumer, there's hopefully a roughly constant amount of processing that information that's coming in. That is, what speakers try to kind of achieve is to have the surprisal of a unit at roughly a constant rate, and the surprisal is essentially the thing here. It's basically Shannon's information here that is a kind of negative logarithm to base 2 of the probability of the unit in a given context. And context can mean different things, like the kind of simplest possible interpretation is if you're a language model, you say kind of what's the probability of the next word given the previous words. But context can also mean things like the visual context. If you have the knowledge that this talk is about kind of this is a talk in this setting here, there is less additional information necessary than when you would hear to it, when you listen to it, just as a recording. And there's also lots of choice with respect to the unit. Good. Here, another example now, factoring in the notion of surprisal. So we have here two example sentences. John accidentally mailed the letter without a stamp versus John went to the shop to buy a stamp. And in this case, John made the letter without a stamp. The surprisal of the word stamp is relatively low versus here it's relatively high. Why that? You have here words like kind of mailed a letter, and there's only a very finite amount of things that you can forget when posting a letter. You can forget the address, you can forget to put the letter inside, and you can forget the stamp, but it's kind of very, very finite set. That is, knowing that kind of the stamp was missing is adding relatively little information. Whereas here, going to a shop and buying something, I should have kind of made this as a game and kind of have let that blank and would have let you guess, you would have guessed much, much longer because a shop offers kind of different types of foods, whatever, clothes, etc. And it takes a while until you figure out that in this case, stamp is the missing word where John went to buy it. That is, the additional bit of information in this case coming from the word stamp is relatively high. So what psycholinguistic experiments show is that when you have a certain message that you want to convey and you have different ways of expressing it, that in general the tendency is to pick an encoding where the information density is roughly constant. As a side remark, you can't get it constant exactly. There is kind of mathematical proof that if information density would be strictly constant, the units would be statistically independent. We know there is correlation in language. Therefore, speakers can only achieve that to a certain degree. Good. So the goal of the overarching project of the CRC is to look into an explanation for all of these phenomena, and several that I haven't mentioned here. I think I've basically, yeah. So here, unit can be the verse, the syntactic unit, a phone. Context can be script, discourse, collocation. Context can, as I mentioned previously, also include the visual context, knowing where people are, knowing what is an image, knowing what's in a visual scene, stuff like that. Good. So the overall CRC is structured in three different areas. And in each area, there are five projects. And each project, on average, has two people, normally a postdoc and a PhD student, working on it. And the project that Andrea, Irina, and Clara will be talking about is in this area C, and is about a special setting, namely kind of if you have two people from different languages, how do they make sure that information is conveyed, and what does this tell us about the relation between those different languages? What else? These are the kind of PIs on this kind of in the CRC, so each of them is managing one or several projects, and the overall, so some of the faces might be known to you, the overall coordinator of the complete thing is Elke Teich. And with that, I want to kind of conclude that section. Are there any questions regarding this kind of bigger framework? No, then I'll be handing over to, I don't know who will start.
Well, I'll start. Hope it works. Okay, so as you can see, our project is called Mutual Intelligibility and Surprisal in Slavic Intercomprehension. My name is Klara Jagrova. I am one of the two Slavic linguists, PhD students, together with Irina. Yeah, we are responsible for the Slavic linguistics part in our project, and Andrea, who's also going to present something about the project, is more for the informatics and language modeling part in the project. So, what we are busy with is a special mode of language use, namely receptive multilingualism, and this is based on the fact that when understanding related language, a speaker doesn't have to be necessarily able to use it for speaking or writing, but every person is able, in a way, to understand a related language receptively. So we are dealing with reading comprehension in our project. Yeah, so if you define, we call it L2, and the other language as a sensory input that will contain some noisy input, of course, then ideally, the person who is trying to understand it will know about some grammatical rules from his L1 that he or she can infer into the second language, and optimally also know about, for example, lexical false friends or any interferences processes that might hinder the understanding. And of course, such intercomprehension between two languages, two related languages, can be asymmetric also. Yeah, for example, there are more words in one language for the same thing than in the other one. Here's a little piece of text with interleaved Czech and Polish information chunks. if you have a look at it, the interesting thing about that is that both Czech and Polish speakers are able to understand this bit of text, more or less, yeah? Although it doesn't conform to any of the grammatical systems of these languages. Well, so we are investigating mutual intelligibility with the help of empirically oriented linguistic research, which based upon which we will try to build language models, which then will be validated with a series of experiments. Yeah, well, so I'll hand over to Irina. You can see the next slide.
As one of the central questions of our project is how can the mutual intelligibility between closely related languages be measured, and to what extent are we able to understand a text in an unknown by closely related language? And of course, it depends on the number of many differences or cognates between closely related languages at the level of orthography, lexis, morphology, and syntax. And at first, we will focus on these cognates and these differences at the following levels. Yes. So, for example, the first relevant factor for us is orthography. And here you see some orthographic correspondences between Slavic languages. Orthography is very specific and important for Slavic languages because some of the Slavic languages use the Latin alphabet and some the Cyrillic alphabet. And here we see examples for Czech, Polish, Croatian, Bulgarian, Russian, Ukrainian, Belarusian, yes. And very interesting for us are these correspondences, but also differences. Perhaps a Czech reader reading, for example, a Polish word, kon, sorry for my pronunciation, will have no difficulties. Perhaps for a Russian reader, it would be some difficulties by reading a Czech word "kun," yeah, because as a Russia speaker, I see only a Latin letter "u," yeah, and I don't know what kind of correspondences or what kind of differences have I in this example. The next point, using the Levenstein algorithm, the following differences, distances, could be calculated. And here we have some examples for Czech and Polish. And for the first example, we have 30% as distance. For the example B, 30, and for example C, 70. Of course, it is not a perfect factor, but using the Levenstein algorithm, we could calculate these differences. The next relevant factor for our project is lexis, and we distinguish between positive, partial, and negative cognates. Positive cognates or real cognates are words with the same meaning. For example, the words with a common root we will, as Slavic speakers, understand easily. Partial cognates are words with meaning in the same, which have the same meaning in the context. But without context, perhaps we will not recognize or understand these words. And negative cognates are the so-called false friends. Availability of lexical alternatives can lead to asymmetric intelligibility, Clara has mentioned already. For example, some languages have a lot of synonym pairs. In Ukrainian, you have for thank you, a Polish-like word, for example, dikuin, yeah, and a Russian-like word, spasibo. Yeah? And this leads to some asymmetric intelligibility. And perhaps for Ukrainian readers, is easier to understand Polish and Russian words because they have in their language these synonyms. Two languages are closer, that means linguistic distance is lower, when the percentage of cognate as opposite to non-cognate words is higher, and the degree of semantic relatedness is greater, and the degree of lexical relatedness is greater. The next factor is, of course, morphology, and we see here noun declination of the word winter in Czech, Polish, Bulgarian, and Russian. And as morphemes correspondences, we see the ending of three languages, Slavic languages, but for Bulgarian we have some problems, yes? That it will be also interesting how will a Bulgarian reader manage these differences or some problems on the, at the level of morphology. And the next example is present tense forms of verb write, and here we see some correspondences at common root and some correspondences at ending. The next file shows us as overview what we will doing at this level. First of all is linguistic knowledge. We will use all linguistic knowledge at the level of morphology between within the Slavic languages. And the other point is supervised learning of morphology. This is a tool which we are using at our university in Saarbrück. Another question is very important for us, for example, how have grammatical elements developed in the individual languages? Of course, the first languages we have chosen is Czech, Polish, Bulgarian, and Russian. Yeah? And we will focus on this development at the level of morphology, how we in each languages some correspondences or some differences. Also, parallel lists of prefixes and suffixes allow us to work out the meaning of complex words by separating affix elements from roots. All morphemes we will work out separately. And here we have an overview for all these levels, or for the first third factors, orthography, lexis, and morphology. So, and I think the next point is syntax.
We will be looking at the syntactic level in the languages, which Irina already mentioned, that will be under our closer focus. We will discover the common word order, which here in this in these two examples is the same, but in general it is actually free. But all the other levels that we also want to look at, of course, aggregate in syntax. So we will have the morphological elements, which then influence the syntactic level, of course, and also the lexis. For example, you being Czech, trying to read the Polish sentence, you will, you might get confused by the non-cognate list, for example. So we might come across these, or we will come across these difficulties. And if we transliterate the Cyrillic examples, then we will see that they are actually pretty close to the Czech sentences. And for example, here the Polish one seems like the one who's the one that is probably the most distant. And also, there's another phenomenon. We will first be looking at Czech and Polish, the language pair, and there we have the phenomenon in Polish that if you have like certain terms, the adjective is in another position. So you, we will, when we will be aligning our texts, then there will be like a crossing, that we will have to look at. So there are differences and similarities, of course, that we will be looking at. That could be sentence length and types of constituents. What types of phrases are there, most of all? Are there a lot of noun phrases or relative clauses, dependent clauses, and what number of clauses, and positional correspondences or differences? Well, and this all can be measured by using statistical machine translation models. Just to mention previous research on the intercomprehension topic, there has been a research group called Eurocom. I'm not sure if you ever heard about it. This research group was based in Frankfurt, but they apparently stopped working. If you will try to visit their website, you will recognize that it's not maintained anymore. But this was actually done for didactic reasons. So this research group created a, like they called it the seven sieves, which is like a method for receptive language learning or receptive multilingualism. That was the aim, how to understand a text in a related language, and then you should go through these seven steps and then you should be able to understand the related language. And there's also currently some research done at the University of Groningen in the Netherlands, and they've got a project that is called Micrella. If you look for that on the internet, you will find a kind of language game that you can like try yourself being a tested person there. And this is also dealing with mutual intelligibility. But they are also researching on linguistic and non-linguistic factors. So the persons that are taking part in the questionnaire are also asked whether they like the language that they are, that they will be presented in the text, or what is their attitude towards the language. So, like, if they prefer to hear this language or like it, then they will probably be more open-minded towards it. And in the past, there was already a project on linguistic determinants in Scandinavian languages done by Groningen University. Okay, so now I'll hand over to Andrea again.
Works. Good. So the previous has illustrated the different factors and also some previous work that we'll have to all factor in our project. Now, to boil that down to our mission statement, we want to first take these traditional pieces of knowledge, these traditional assumptions, see how far we can validate them or maybe even reject them. And well, of course, in the overarching CRC, we want to consider the N and decoding. So we want to understand how the languages differ in how they convey information, both in the generative and in the receptive direction. Of course, we want to empirically validate or falsify our theories we come up with, so we'll have to do a lot of experiments. And then we hope that in the end, after this big project, we'll come up with some empirically well-founded bases for applications as varied as machine translation, inferring shared grammars, or maybe even metatic or didactic purposes. So, we have split the project. We have different subtasks to do. So, for example, we have to first find information, find corpora, analyze them, find out what information is there. Of course, we have to do the statistical modeling, and we have to run experiments. But all of these will have effects with all the other ones. So we're not sure yet whether we can really say this is so well differentiated, but rather it might be a fluent process. In the end, we have a big ambitious goal, which is the Slavic intercomprehension matrix. Now, I think this requires a bit of explanation what we have here. Each language appears in a row and a column. The rows indicate that, for example, in the first row, you are a speaker of Russian natively. Then the column indicates which other Slavic language you are trying to intercomprehend. Yeah? So, for example, here, 14 Bulgarian with one Russian is modeling the Bulgarian speaker trying to understand Russian. And now we have, so these numbers here, they have previously caused some confusion, so let me just mention that they are just for orientation so you can more quickly resolve what this exact cell in the matrix refers to. So now there's this traditional bit of knowledge which places Upper Sorbian very close to Lower Sorbian, or says that Czech and Slovak are very related. And we have tried to indicate that here by the color codes. Yeah? Now, you see there's a bit of traditional knowledge, however, there are many, many blank cells. We want to fill in all of these blank cells, and we want to challenge or verify these traditional assumptions about the different degrees of relatedness of the different languages. And ideally, we would want to do that in such a way that the resulting model actually has modular components. So don't take this at any kind of mathematical face value. This is just for illustrative purposes. We also want to say that we model someone who is, for example, able to understand Russian, Polish, and Bulgarian, and then use that, all of that background knowledge, in order to understand, in this example, Czech. Good. Now, all of this has been very abstract. We've only so far mentioned the general factors we have to look at. Let's look at one possible way of how we could make this really a mathematical model. So it is, I would say, possible. It's not particularly easy. It's not particularly easy to find the best model, but it is possible to come up with statistical models for language. So, for example, if a Polish person reads a Polish text, we would say we model this by a statistical model predicting Polish words given Polish histories. Now, our intercomprehension setting, well, it's a bit different. The speaker we are modeling has a native model of a different language. Now, what we can do, or we can formulate this in terms of machine translation or language model adaptation. And then we would have to map all the involved words from one language to the other. So if the Czech person tries to understand Polish, the model will have to account for the difference for mapping from the Polish to the native Czech, and then mapping the correct word to be predicted as well. And we could propose two different alternatives. In one, we might consider all the possible histories and combinations that could have led to this observation, or we could also just say that we make a hard pick and we only pick the most likely translation. Good. So, we know it's a very ambitious project, and we're only in the very beginning stages. We're currently gathering and processing corpora, and we are here in order to try and establish a collaboration. We will soon try to implement first experiments, which we hope to find collaborators for among you, which would consider first the Czech-Polish setting, and then very soon after that, Russian and Bulgarian, I believe it was. Good. So that concludes our little presentation, and we would like to have lots of discussion with you now. Thank you very much for your attention.
Maybe my question is that, I'm not really sure how you want to get the people, because like a lot of Slavic people have some knowledge of the other Slavic languages, so how do you account for that?
Well, I suppose there we would have to depend on some local people to help us, but you are right, it will be hard to control for that, so we will probably have to factor that into these non-linguistic determinants.
Because like for Czech people, like most of Czech people know some Slovak language.
Yes. And
Czech people who live close to the Polish border know Polish language. So if you imagine first maybe including a test determining how well the person actually knows the language.
Yes, then, we would have to something like probably include that. Yeah. Do we have any concrete plans? Dietrich or Tanja? Yes.
Pick from kind of central part of a country, like Prague children are actually pretty good sample of children yes. knowing only Czech.
Yes, we we have already talked about that. We will probably have to go to high school level or maybe even earlier in order to get uninfluenced people.
So,
no, it was just we'll just make it sound better.
Just a very small remark. Yes, you're right. I think that the better than young children is elder children, because I have my very small example when my children was. In the preschool age, they were not able to understand Slavic. Slovak. I'm sorry.
Different language.
But now, when they were older, yes. they can understand very well.
Mm-hmm. So I have one question and two remarks. The question is, I would like to, if you have some. Suggestions I would be interested in the experiments. I mean, in the technicalities of the experiments. We mentioned some. I mean, there's the subjects of the experiments. But if you have some other, I mean, there may be. I can imagine there may be experiments of different kinds. So I would like to know more about them. And then one. Question to your presentation about the surprisal or the you had the two examples with the send the mail or letters without putting a stamp on it, and then the other one. I think it really depends. At the first sight, I would have agreed with you, but then when I thought about the examples in a more detail, I think it really depends which kind of question the sentence answers. Because if I have something like, why was he angry, or why his parents didn't talk to him anymore? Well, they didn't talk to him anymore because he mailed the letter without a stamp, which can be supposed. And the second sentence is quite, I mean, it was quite clear that it would answer a certain question. So I think this surprisal measure also does not depend only on the sentential context, but it also depends on the context in which the sentence is uttered. And it seems to me that this is not what the measure could capture. Yeah.
Okay, so let's perhaps do it in reverse order, because the microphone is still here. Kind of so I have the same suspicion for the example with the stamp, that if you would actually train a language model on a representative corpus, things might turn out differently. So we had just kind of last week a discussion kind of from a project that was mentioned here explicitly with a colleague from the Germanistics department about kind of shortenings of sentences, and I'm pretty sure that his expectation for kind of when a surprise high or low that comes from his theories kind of linguistic insights, I'm just curious to see how this goes when we actually train language models or other models that include context and actually measure it. There might be either noise, there might be other aspects that influence that, so that will be seeing it that clearly. So these examples came from colleagues from psycholinguistics, so seeing it that clearly will probably be a rather difficult endeavor.
For the experiment.
No, it was just the, yeah. The experiment and some more details about what you, which kind of experiment do you expect? Starting with very simple, very time tasks to eye tracker experiments, because we still don't know exactly what experiments we are testing. So it's very much like at this stage we view the experiments rather as validation of our results from the language modeling, and it will be constructed texts, constructed experiments, control texts, in order to know exactly what we're testing. So at this point we will go for the simpler type of tests. More at this point, it's really open. It depends very much on what exactly it will be, what kind of subject it will be.
I'd like to ask about the cooperation with partner universities. Are you looking for, let us say, innocent people or native speakers who don't have Polish or for?
When you had, some of you had this table with the correspondences, and you had also graphic, morphosyntactic, etc. Of course, he probably, from the linguistic point of view, would not say also graphic, but would classify them as morphosyntactic. But he has very intricate sort of system of also based on diachronic aspects of the comparison of Slavic morphosyntax. So, I mean, I can imagine, well, I think that, or I would guess as from what you have said, that this project does not include only the practical point of view or application point of view, but also is going to be based on linguistic observations.
Yeah, it could be also viewed as a slavistics project.
Yes, and I think, so,
so I think about it.
Okay, so you know Patrice Pognin, at least his work,
and I think his.
Yeah. So I think he would be a real contribution to the linguistic aspects.
Interessant, er scheint gerade ausgetopft gewesen zu sein, aber ja, wir standen immer noch.
I wanted to ask something related about the phonetics or phonology. I haven't seen it there, so. Are you only going to work with texts, or are you also going to work with speech a little bit? Because sometimes the experience is that people actually understand once it's written.
Yes.
But sometimes they don't understand, especially at first, they don't understand, for instance, between Czech and Polish because of different accent and because of phonetical differences.
Yes.
So sometimes if you just pronounce Polish in a Czech way, then Czech people actually understand it?
Yes. So we are planning to first focus on tax corpora, but we are hoping to get up to two more terms for this project, so it would be really a long-term thing, 12 years, and we hope that we'll find time to also investigate spoken language and the differences and similarities there, but not in the very first phase.
Just one remark, which, I mean, it's a side remark, but because I don't know almost anything about that point, which I would like to mention. But that point is that with the, it is said, and I mean, our Slavic specialists can correct me, that for instance, between Czech and Polish, if a Czech person can understand more easily Polish than the Polish person can understand Czech, or maybe the other way around. So my question would be, I think you also should take into account this direction,
Oh yes.
Languages.
So the idea of the plan, kind of our hidden agenda is first coming here, because kind of we have long-standing collaboration, and you see kind of how good Czechs would understand Polish, and then of course in year two we'll also do the reverse experiment. By then having established a collaboration with also for example Polish University, and then doing the reverse experiment.
And let me mention at that point that we have thrown around the word distance quite liberally here. We're not talking about mathematical distance, which would be symmetric, but rather really a similarity or dissimilarity measure. So this would not necessarily be symmetric, and the metrics thus also would not have to be symmetric.
I would just like to ask, have you also considered, for example, people whose native language is not Slavic but have learned one Slavic language, how well do they understand other Slavic languages?
I think we have not explicitly considered that yet, because the initial task really is to see how mastery of one language helps you. Although it would also be interesting to see how a non-native speaker of a Slavic language, how well that such a person would be able to intercomprehend. But I think it would be more, I mean, the setting would be even more wide, right?
Yeah,
because
that's true. It will be even more difficult to get us enough subjects. And
yes, just today I was able to infer a word because of a bit of knowledge of Spanish. But really, you're mixing different language families, and then the problem space gets much bigger. And we are trying to focus, at least at first, only on the Slavic languages. Maybe in a later stage of the project we would be able to consider that setting, because we also have the idea of expanding that to the Romance family later on.
Okay. I'm thinking about the when we mentioned the children, and then Marketa said that her children, as they grew older, they started to understand Slovak. So I'm actually thinking about, it's just a note, about you said mastery of the language, so that's why you're looking for native speakers. And I think it's just a wild guess that actually how well you know your native language, that there's vast differences in terms of
yes.
especially size of vocabulary.
Yes.
And that will probably strongly influence how well you understand the other
yes.
Slavic languages.
Yes.
Because a lot of those synonyms that help you understand the other language are actually quite uncommon, for instance, synchronously.
Yes.
So for instance, list as a letter is an older Czech synonym that is not contemporarily being used.
Mm-hmm.
But as if you understand, if you've read some things from 19th century
yes.
and older, then it's perfectly comprehensible and sounds normal, actually.
Yes.
So your mileage might differ. Yes.
You're perfectly right. So the way I see it, it's really this modular thing.
I actually wanted to note or somehow try to examine the knowledge yes. of the first language.
Exactly. The mechanisms in the NND coding that are available, which we try to reflect that a bit in the demo slide for the matrix, where we said, well, we want to also be able to take the combined knowledge of language A and B in order to understand language C. But of course, you're right. Actually, we would have to split the mastery, the knowledge of language A, into subfields, into submechanisms, and then see how these mechanisms are translated when going across languages.
Are you going to measure the relatedness of languages, of Slavic languages, just within families like Western Slavonic languages and Eastern and so on? Because it looked like that in your table, but it would be interesting for me to know how far I can understand Bulgarian, for example.
Yes, so I would say in that respect, our slide with the table might be a bit misleading overall, and I'm hoping I'm not breaking it again. So here we have partitioned them according to traditional knowledge, and then we have tried to indicate what the traditional knowledge says, but really we want to fill out everything there.
Because you asked about Czech native speakers understanding Polish, but not yes. about understanding
other. Well, we have to start somewhere.
Like maybe in future or I don't know, at some stage in the project, it would also be interesting to elicit other known languages of the persons that we will be testing, and then maybe derive in how far they influence the understanding as well, because I think that would be also interesting to, for example, a Czech who can also speak Russian. Is he or she more able or more easily able to understand Polish? Yeah, that is like the added component here then. Or maybe, I don't know, Latin as well, and then derive some pieces of, I don't know, word formation or, yeah, some information from even other languages outside of the language family, of the Slavic family. So it would also be a nice thing to focus on, I think. But
Yeah, so we know that it's a big project. Maybe the 12 years won't be enough if we get them. But we'll have to see how it pans out overall.
Why I have asked about the technicalities of the experiments, because I think that the experiments will have to take into account many features.
Yes.
And
yes.
I'm glad to hear here how many features we have just had in our minds, so to say, not thinking too much or too deep, but just thinking of some features which might be important to take into account. And so that's, I think, is very it's very nice to talk about this, because more people, more suggestions.
Yes, so that is exactly why we came here and what we were hoping
yeah,
for.
Yeah, so, and also we have learned about the intentions of your project, which I think is also very, very good to hear. So, are there some more suggestions to be added? Well, if not, then I would like to thank you again for coming here, for giving us the opportunity to see some details about the project, and also to give us an opportunity to think and talk about our possible cooperation as I said, which started those 20 years ago. So we may go back and see what we can do together. So thank you very much once more.
Thank you very much for having us, and thank you very much for all your input.